So thank you for coming again. Welcome to Hungry Planet Healthy Schools. I'm Celeste Choate. I'm one of the associate directors at the Ann Arbor District Library, and I've had the great pleasure to work with members of the health science libraries at the University of Michigan and members of MISH-R, which is the place that works with translational research, which is getting research information, clinical research information to the public and to the researchers. They have a fantastic website available at www.umengage.org. So if you are interested in learning more about clinical research opportunities that would be available to you, if you have a particular condition that runs in your family and you'd like to learn more about clinical research that would be available to you or to family members, then this is a place to go, and you will be notified when studies that are appropriate to you and your personal situation are ready for you, and you can participate or pass that information along to friends or family. So that website is www.umengage.org. I hope you're excited about tonight's event as we are. We have Peter Menzel, who wrote the book and took the photos for Hungry Planet, which is a fantastic book, again, available for sale. And then after Peter's talk, Dr. Kim Eagle is going to speak about Project Healthy Schools available in the Ann Arbor and other public school system. So without any further ado, Peter.
Sends her regrets, the co-author of Hungry Planet. I couldn't get through tonight without saying that. Actually, I couldn't go home without saying that. But Faith DeLucio is the writer, reporter, and extraordinary food stylist that helped me with, she's also my wife, so that's another reason that I need to say these things to you. But good evening, and let's see if this equipment works. I think we're gonna be in luck here. We're all pretty much familiar with multitasking, right? Here's an example of it. This is natural food preservation and satellite television. Sometimes it all comes together, as it did here on the back porch of a small store in the Himalayas. The reason that Faith couldn't be here is we're working on another big nutrition project that has a book deadline that's looming ominously close. But now, don't just think that you can sit back, though, for the next 40 minutes. You're going to have to do a lot of work, because I'm going to show you a lot of pictures very fast and present a lot of facts that we've gleaned from our travels around the world. If you want to see them slower, you're going to have to read the book. Faith and I spent our lives exploring humanity in all its messy, complicated, raucous, cacophonous, strange, and wonderfully imperfect glory. We've done lots of different worldwide projects, but over the last decade or so, we've been exploring food. We've done lots of different people in different countries, and before we actually begin that tour, I want to take you on a tour around the United States for a few minutes so I can show you where our food comes in this country. A lot of people maybe already know this, but just bear with me because some of the pictures are nice. Traditionally, food was raised on local farms all over the United States, on family farms, by farmers working with their families. They raised animals and plants on the same farm and used the manure of the animals to fertilize their crops. But now, the vast majority of the 90,000 beef cattle slaughtered every day in the United States spend their much shortened lives in huge factory farm feedlots. The image we have, though, of Nature Valley, USA, has been carefully crafted by agribusiness marketers who would like us to believe that shredded wheat is being harvested in idyllic places among the rolling hills of agriculture America, and hardy farm boys collect eggs from happy, healthy chickens. The other thing is that families always pray before eating. But maybe you shouldn't be so cynical about praying if your breakfast is a heart attack and a prayer. In the United States, we do have a lot of cheap food. We spend only 10% of our incomes on food. 5% of the eggs that we eat do not come from happy chickens. The egg-laying chicken's entire life is spent indoors in these huge factories packed into cages stacked on top of each other. A typical chicken has 5 cellmates, and it's obviously not good to have a ground floor apartment They can be especially foul. Turkey Town is not quite as bad, but if you believe in reincarnation and you're claustrophobic, you should avoid coming back as a turkey. A lot of you probably wonder about reproduction in these crowded conditions. Male turkeys are so big that female turkeys have to be artificially inseminated. So this man here is spending his 8-hour shift pipetting sperm from male turkeys to be inserted in female turkeys. So the turkeys do get to see the light of day on their final outing, but it's on their way to the slaughterhouse, where the efficiency of the disassembly line has been perfected. It's been perfected to make our meat less expensive. But what goes with chicken and turkey? The answer is, for many of us around the world, rice, which is the most important staple food for a large part of the world's population. Rice has the second highest worldwide production after corn. And this may be how you think rice is farmed everywhere, like here in the foothills of the Himalayas, or in Egypt, irrigated by Nile River water. Rice is harvested by hand in most places, like here near Chiang Mai. But in the US, who's going to bend over and plant rice in a flooded paddy? The answer is virtually no one. Rice is seeded from crop duster airplanes today and harvested by huge combines after the fields are drained and dried. 15% of US rice is used to make beer, mostly by Anheuser-Busch for Budweiser, which may be why so many Americans ask, why am I so heavy when all I drink is Bud Light? How does all this water get in the fields? Well, it's our tax money. Huge public works irrigation systems in California's Central Valley do the trick for a major portion of California. But often the pesticides, herbicides, and fertilizer gets into the water too. But don't let the thought of all those chemicals in our water spoil your appetite for a hamburger. It's time to meet your meat. Remember those huge factory farm feedlots mentioned just a minute ago? This is one in California that has 100,000 head. And when you have this many cattle in one place, defecating 25 pounds of manure each and every day with no sewage system, many stand around in pools of manure. 6 months eating grain, which cattle have trouble digesting, by the way. The grain is also laced with antibiotics to prevent diseases in the crowded pens. And then, with some electric prodding, the final roundup. Here's the feedlot pantry, so to speak, huge silos and elevators where the grain is stored and mixed, all very, very efficient, because this is big money. This feedlot is one of the biggest in the United States. It's also adjacent to the factory in Idaho where McDonald's French fries are manufactured, and the cattle are conveniently fattened on the potato waste from the French fry factory. So are you loving it? Big business hopes you are. McDonald's spends $800 million advertising its products each year, while the National Cancer Institute spends $1 million promoting fruits and vegetables. But here's back to the food factory. I hope everyone's eaten already. This is the next stop for the fattened cows, the undressing room. The trick is to get the manure-caked hides off the carcasses without contaminating the meat. Has anyone read the story in Sunday's New York Times about a young woman paralyzed by a Cargill's hamburger? You can see it online. It's kind of interesting. And this explains some of it. Again, another disassembly line. And into the cooler to age for a week or two before the choice age steaks end up like this, juicy and grilled. But where do the trimmings go from all this? I really like the mortgage crisis analogy. Bankers and financial wizards sliced and diced and resold mortgages until no one knew where they came from. The same with hamburger meat. It comes from hundreds of different animals all over the world, and calling some of the additives meat is a real stretch. Anyway, these trimmings go into your burgers, and the less desirable parts of hundreds of cows are mixed together in a typical hamburger factory like this one in southern Minnesota, where the patties are flash frozen and then ready for the grill. The foreman of the factory, who was cooking these burgers for us at his house after I photographed the factory, warned us to always cook our hamburgers until they are well done, and he emphasized well, because he said there's too much risk of food poisoning from fecal matter if you don't kill the bacteria with lots of heat. Again, check out that New York Times story. You won't probably be eating as many hamburgers as you used to. But how about a slice of juicy heirloom tomatoes from our home garden on that burger? This is our home garden. No, not really, not for most of us, because remember, agriculture is a business, and in America, it's big business. Tomatoes are bred to be able to withstand mechanical harvesters. That's why you can drop a supermarket tomato, and it tends to bounce rather than splat. The first of these were flavor-saver, genetically engineered tomato plants developed in California. They had a gene that allowed the fruit to ripen on the vine without softening. They didn't need ripening with ethylene gas, and they were not damaged during shipping. It was supposedly a huge breakthrough. But they looked better than they tasted, and that turned out to be, this whole enterprise turned out to be uneconomical, and therefore they were phased out after a few years, after Monsanto bought the patent for the gene. Today, soup sauces and tomato ketchup are made from the other varieties that are able to withstand mechanical harvesting. All right, it's time for dinner. Let's go pig out at a restaurant, one of millions across America. Welcome to a mid-sized swine farm in Iowa. These pigs live in close quarters, but that's better than individual pens with automated feeders where the animals can't even turn around. Newborns are vaccinated, and then their tails clipped off. Why? Because confined, frustrated, bored pigs tend to nip at each other's tails, which slows their growth, and that's bad for business. 6 to 10 months later, they're onto the killing floor. The hogs swing through a gauntlet of flame to singe off their hair, and then get dehoofed and gutted and disassembled for your ham dinner or your sandwich, or for bacon to flesh out that breakfast we just saw to accompany the unhappy chicken eggs. Here in the USA, we eat more than 250 pounds of meat per person every year, which is like eating one whole hog or half a side of beef. The Western idea of dinner, a little veggies with our meat, is substantially different from that of the rest of the world, where dinner is more apt to mean a tiny bit of meat with our grain and vegetables, or meat used to add just flavor. Here in the USA, we seem to have lots of choice in the supermarket. In reality, though, much of the choice is specious. Between 20 types of frozen pizza, 15 brands of chips, or 10 different kinds of sugary soft drinks, that seems to be the choice. But now let's take a look at what the rest of the world is eating. You may have seen photos from this book in various places on various blogs and websites, and maybe even in your inbox, because after they escaped from the Time Magazine website, they appeared everywhere. This work focuses on what families around the world eat in 1 week's time. The dollar amount above the picture is the price of the food for 1 week. Basic nutrition is essential to life everywhere, but the way humans have learned to approach it, based on life circumstances and geography, is as amazing as the cultural diversity of people and their traditions. This project included 30 families in 24 countries. And there's a detailed grocery list in the book with every single item. We visited hundreds of people in their homes and kitchens around the world, not just to talk about food, but to eat together, to compare notes, and over time develop interesting comparisons, which we then develop into books, hopefully to help our fellow humans understand themselves and each other. We visited... One of the main reasons why we're so interested in food is because we really like to eat, and people seem to really enjoy feeding us too. We discovered the seed of the idea for Hungry Planet in a very remote place. It was about 1998. We were in the western side of Papua New Guinea. At one time this was called Irian Jaya, and now it's called Papua. Faith and I spend about half of the year working in other parts of the world, and in the late 90s, it was the late 90s, we were working in the Azmat, and it's the world's largest, hottest swamp. We were deep in the jungle watching the Plipas family process starch from sago palms to make sago flour, which is their staple. staple food of these hunter-gatherers, and it's kind of an amazing process to see them go in with an axe into a jungle, cut a tree down, and then manufacture all these pipes and sieves and different manufacturing type things that they use to process sago flour right there. They dig a hole and get the water out of the ground and sago flour, which doesn't have many nutrients in it. So each time these families cut a tree down, which would be about one a week, because that's how much flour they would get out of the whole thing, enough for their family for the whole week, they would leave part of it to rot. And when they returned, they would harvest the fat, juicy grubs living in the rotten log. These are Capricorn beetle larvae. And then, of course, they'd roast them and eat them. And this is their main source of protein. We came upon a man and his sons carrying a package of instant noodles. Logging money had just begun to trickle into this remote area, and with it, the first merchant selling dried food and snacks. But we watched as one boy ate the noodles and his brother ate the dry flavor pack. Now, these are people with a serious nutritional deficiencies and debilitations. And you don't have to really be a food activist to wonder if it's a good idea for people already struggling to get basic nourishment to dose themselves with jolts of sugar, salt, and artificial flavor. Carbonated soft drinks had arrived as well, and we began to wonder what the heck everyone else on the planet was eating. So that was the beginning of Hungry Planets. We realized that people everywhere are faced with different food issues depending on the country that they live in. And all too often, there are political reasons for being underfed. There's civil unrest, tribal warfare, landmines. All of these can lead to famine. Farmland becomes inaccessible and dangerous, and transportation very risky. In many places, it takes very little to unlink the food chain. Sometimes that chain remains unlinked for many years, though, as it has in the Congo, in Sudan, and Chad, where we were covering a family in the Brejing refugee camp, and we met Jamia Suleiman and her family. This camp is just one of many, many along the Chad-Sudan border. You probably know how they came to be here, though. It was to escape the treachery of the government-supported Arab Janjaweed. But one of the underlying causes is desertification of the Darfur desert region of Sudan, which makes farmers and herders vie for a smaller and smaller piece of real estate. This is one of Jamia's fellow refugees sifting through the sand for grains of militant sorghum dropped during the food distribution, all in order to just get a few extra grains for her family for the week. But when the weather's good and there's peace, even very poor people can manage to eat adequately. But whether it's reaching for the cheese in Latvia or choosing a multinational soft drink in Namibia, they're trying to figure out what flavor of Kool-Aid to buy in North Carolina. In the developed world, the issue is often too much choice, and those choices are often confusing and not very healthy. And sometimes it's a stretch to even call what we're buying food. The overabundance of unhealthy choices is causing another unlinking of that now proverbial food chain. In the year 2000, the World Watch Institute reported that for the first time in recorded history, there were just as many overfed people as underfed people on the planet. These numbers may have changed given the rise in world food prices, but the underlying fact is that some of us, mostly in the so-called developed world, are eating ourselves to death. Let's take a look at some numbers, though. This is from the U.S. Center for Disease Control. This is going to take just a few seconds to run through, but basically we're looking at obesity taking over America. And this is happening all over the world because advances in technology and transportation, along with rising income, have caused our species everywhere to replace their simple diets with one more rich in fat, sugars, and salt, causing a lot of people to be unhealthy. So, but where are the healthiest diets on the planet? Often they're not in the richest countries. This is our Hungry Planet family in Mali, the Ntomos, who are eating a largely grain-based diet along with seasonal fruits and vegetables, as does our Chadian family, the Mustafas. Both are rural, and though they are poor, and food quantity and viability is greatly dependent on the weather, they generally eat a balanced diet with little or no empty calories. In other places where traditional foods and style of living are still the norm, even impoverished people are eating more healthily than we are. What they don't do, though, in most of these places is eat their animals, because they're the family's bank account. So this family in the Andes in Ecuador sell a sheep every once in a while, and they do that in order to buy more grain and potatoes, because that will last much longer than the meat from that animal. But of course, without access to clean water and good health care, they have other issues to contend with. Here's a place with no flies, though. This is Greenland. It's the only settlement within 1,000 miles on the eastern coast. This is the village of Etok, and this is where Emil Madsen, who was one of the last working seal hunters in Greenland, picked us up on his dog sled and took us 2 hours back to his village of Cap Hope. And the first hour of the trip, he spent checking his cell phone messages before he got out of range. Here we are back in Cap Hope. Three families only live here now. When he lived there, there were 15. His dad, also a seal hunter, is buried on this hill. So in order to get the full flavor of Greenland, we went hunting with Emil and his family for a week on their 2 dog sleds. And the kids made a game of running from sled to sled to keep warm and relieve boredom. And Faith learned to take notes with mittens on. This is the end of May. It was literally the midnight sun. We stopped here at the ice edge near some Manhattan-sized icebergs to look for seals for supper. Emil uses the icebergs for navigation, but because of the warming climate, he worries that they won't be there much longer. Emil shot one seal, but it sank before he could get to it. We had better luck with ice fishing. We stopped at this glacial-fed lake, pitched our tents, and chopped through 4 feet of ice to fish for Arctic char, which then Emil cooked up for dinner, which was one of the best meals we had while working on the book Hungry Planet. This is fresh Arctic char with curry and rice from a pristine glacial-fed lake. Emil finally did get his seal, though. We went out on a powerboat with him just before we left. In the front of the boat are his 2 kids who fell asleep because it's already after midnight. Luckily, they didn't wake up at the last minute and get their heads blown off. But he did wake them up when he got back to his back to Cap Hope and got the kids to drag the seal up to the house, where the next morning his wife got to clean it. And as you probably know, women in most countries get the dirty work. Traditional foods are still Emil's favorite, but most of his children chose something quite different when asked to name their favorite food. Julian here likes sugary granola and reconstituted milk. He prefers that way more than dried cod dipped in fish. During breakfast, he played air guitar while watching satellite MTV. Most tables in Greenland now look like this. There's highly processed food, courtesy of the shipping lanes, and Greenland's status is a Danish protectorate. But the bounty of the traditional hunt is still evident here. And you can see in the foreground there's some birds, and then there's a big hunk of muskox, and then there's a piece of polar bear steak. And it was amazing going hunting with, or just being on these dog sleds with Emil, and he's got 3 different kinds of rifles and shotguns, and anything that flies, crawls, or swims by, he's got a gun out within a half a second, and he's blasting away at it. But most of the food on that table there comes from Denmark, as I was saying, and it's highly processed. And that is the way that most of the world is going. These indigenous foods in the foreground are being replaced and crowded out by the processed foods. So who's making all this food? It's multinational food companies. They have these crafty multinationals have to find new markets in order to grow, and they've learned that in order to grow, they need to enter the developing world because they've pretty much saturated the developed world markets. Mexico is a prime example as a neighbor and direct trading partner. They have lots of access to the U.S. global marketplace. Here we are with Alma Casales and her family. They live in Cuernavaca, Mexico. They have access to great produce and seafood. But more often than not, their purchases of highly processed food are canceling out any healthy eating habits that they might have. There's an additional problem in Mexico for even traditional leaders, though. It's traditional Mexican food is great fuel for the physically active, And unfortunately, though, the Mexican population is not that active anymore. They're much more like Americans. They're driving and sitting in front of their TVs, and they're having desk jobs. This is the Casales family with their 1 week's worth of food. And what people comment most about when they see this picture of the Aimes is the 6 gallons of Coca-Cola lined up against the back wall. And when we met them, the Casales family was drinking it for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Alma, who was educated as a nurse, was surprised to learn that the gallons of Coca-Cola that she was buying for her family consisted solely of sugar water. But her son's teeth were sort of evidence to that. And it was surprising to us, though, that Mexico now ranks number one in world per capita consumption of Coca-Cola. Alma's family has type 2 diabetes and obesity on both sides of the family. People in the so-called developed world, though, are usually shocked when they see the physical amount and the kind of food they eat in the course of 1 week's time. This was certainly the case for Rosemary and her family in North Carolina. We covered 3 American families for Hungry Planet. Rosemary's was one of them. This was interesting because the family had just embarked the month before on a plan to lose some weight. So they all joined a health club, and they really went at it. The entire family participated 2 or 3 nights a week for a good hour, hour and a half. Everybody really, really worked up a sweat. But this left less time for them to make home-cooked meals. So they began eating more fast food than they did before that they decided to get healthy. And when we did the picture of their week's worth of food, they were shocked to see the amount and kind of food that they were eating. This highly processed, over-sugared, low in nutrition food, and a lot of it. So after the photo, they promptly changed their eating habits. Rosemary told us later that 2 of the boys had especially had a big hand in making this dietary change. Since then, they've really cut back, and one of the boys has written a review of Hungry Planet that you can read on Amazon.com, and he's really proud of the fact that he was part of the project and that it changed his life. So we feel good about that. This is another way to fight obesity, though. It's through moderation. We traveled to Okinawa, which is the southernmost island in the Japanese archipelago, because it has the highest percentage of 100-year-olds of any place on the planet. We were looking to see if diet or lifestyle or customs account for the longevity of the population. And the answer we found was very ambiguous, of course, because there is no one simple answer to these questions. But to a dedicated fish lover like myself, these brightly colored fish look like candy, but they're obviously much better for you. But seeing tropical fish like this in a market and then being able to bring them to an upstairs restaurant was a real treat. The fish here, we're in the same market as this. This is the Naha City Municipal Market, and they had other stalls that were packed with pickled produce, which also aids in good digestion. This is another vegetable. It's called goya. It's bitter melon, and it was considered one of the longevity foods by Okinawans, and they eat a lot of it. And researchers are now looking into this. It's sort of like resveratrol in a green form. But even with lots of urban stress, the Japanese have a healthy lifestyle. Construction workers begin their day with exercise. Until recently, this was a rule throughout most of corporate Japan, but it's starting to be on the wane. It doesn't really stop with old age, though, which is venerated in Japan, which is a real treat to see, because this is a senior center in the small city of Nago, Okinawa. And it has a caring, community-based nursing staff. The assistants and the staff know every patient, and they certainly don't park them drugged up in front of a TV set all day like I've seen happen here in the United States. It's more like a spa than a typical senior center in any other country, this one full of elderly people taking foot baths, enjoying deep water massage, and lunching with friends. But we were really lucky because we were there on a weekend when the entire community turned out at a nursing home for birthday celebrations. There were 3 people that were in their 90s and low 100s. And I love this especially because it was all-you-can-eat sushi and beer. And the entire community really got into it. This was a great celebration. Here's 97-year-old Matsu Sakimi with her great-granddaughter. Her great-granddaughter your great-granddaughter applied this purple eyeshadow. Here's a typical meal in a traditional restaurant. It's high in protein and nutrients, low in calories. Here we have 96-year-old Matsu, and she stopped by to have lunch with us before going to work in her potato patch. And she explained the phrase harahachabu, which maybe you've heard, which is part of a Japanese and Okinawan tradition. It means 80%. And as kids, they were taught to eat only until 80% full and then stop. They weren't taught to clean their plates two or three times and stuff themselves. So here's another lady we met. This is 90-year-old Haruku Maeda. She's cutting her lawn by hand on her hands and knees in Ogimi Village outside of her little modest house. And while she was doing this in the 95-degree heat, her son came home from work. Her son was in his 60s, and he just walked right by, said hello, and turned on the TV set and popped himself a soda. So our Hungry Planet family in Okinawa had a centenarian too, and that's the reason we chose this family there. We saw some other examples, though, of Japanese students eating nutritious foods, but this is one of the big fears in Japan. Studies suggest that Japan's younger generation may not live as long as their grandparents because of less exercise and diets higher in saturated fats and calories. And the mantra, harahachabu, eat only until 80% full, may be falling by the wayside. This is happening in America too. I mean, this coming generation may be the first one that has a lower life expectancy than the current generation. Thank you very much. So I think Dr. Eagle is going to tell us a lot of interesting things, and I'm going to let Al do the change. Okay?
I have had this experience before. A few years ago, I was invited to speak at a sort of a Camp Michigania thing, and I thought, well, this will be great. You know, there's going to be a professor and then me. Well, it was actually an astronaut, and and he showed a picture of a spacewalk. And that was really tough to follow. So I'm going to talk to you about something far closer to home, Project Healthy Schools. This is an effort which is a community-wide effort to try to think about how can we improve the health of our kids, my children, your children, your grandchildren, perhaps. It started about 6 or 7 years ago in one school, and now it's in 13 schools in Michigan. And it's a simple effort to think about what we currently do and ask ourselves, and especially these kids, let's focus on things that we think can make a difference and see if we can move in the direction of health. Great, thank you. So, as Peter alluded to, we have a huge problem with obesity in our nation. It's amazing to me that the richest country in the world is treating its health problem with bypass surgery of the stomach, and the poorest nations in the world are starving to death. What an amazing contrast that is. In our nation, we have more than 9 children who are overweight, and this has tripled in the last 25 years. Obesity among kids aged 2 to 5 has increased 35% in 10 years. It is said that we form our palate. What do we like? Salt, fat, and sugar, the big three, by age 4 to 5. So the Happy Meals have a clear target, and our kids get hooked on those, and our palate is set. And it is very hard to say no once we've tasted those items. Minorities in our country are at higher risk. African-American girls are about twice as likely as non-Hispanic girls to be overweight or obese. And 27% of Mexican-American boys are overweight or obese compared to 14%. So this is a much larger problem, as you know, in urban America. And lower income families have bigger kids. Single parents struggling to feed a family of 3 or 4 may go by and buy a couple of pizzas and a big soda or two and feel like, you know what, we survived another day. That is what it's like. This slide illustrates the percentage of overweight among kids 6 to 19 in the last 25 to 30 years, and you just see this amazing rise of an epidemic. And it is true, Peter, that we estimate in America our children will live less long than we do for the first time ever in this country. What do we need to do? Well, it's almost too big to think about, isn't it? But we have to attack from the bottom up and from the top down. Individuals and families and communities, we need recreational facilities and parks. We need grocery stores that have healthy food, and we need health programs. I'm going to talk tonight about schools, which I think represent a wonderful unit of intervention to begin and change a culture. More physical activity, increased time in PE, better nutritional offerings, free breakfasts for the underserved. These have great potential. And healthcare systems need to be involved too. Screenings, measuring BMI, investing in prevention. We must do this. Our kids are riding on it. Michigan is not in good shape, literally. We have the 9th worst obesity rate in the country, and that translates into the 11th worst rate of diabetes. Okay? And our kids are right up there. If you look at children in Washtenaw County, more than half spend 75 or more minutes per day on TV, computer, video games. And how many go to the park and play and work out, maybe like I did? Very few. If you look at the number of adolescents who do more than five times 30 minutes, 150 minutes a week, it is in a free fall over the last 15 to 20 years. So no wonder we have the problem. And I like this slide especially. A Coca-Cola in 1950 was 6.5 ounces. Do any of you remember those? They were little tiny bottles and they seemed adequate at the time. But then in the 80s they became 12 ounces. That's 10 teaspoons of sugar in a 12 ounce Coke. And then 20 ounce, 15 teaspoons. We saw a child in clinic a couple years ago. He was 16. His parents brought him to clinic because he wanted to take driver's education. But when he got in the truck, the steering wheel caught on his belly. So he couldn't turn the wheel. So they thought this might be a medical problem. His lunch intake was 5 candy bars and a 64-ounce Mountain Dew, which he got in the school lunch program. Unbelievable. So sugar is really a huge part of this issue. So what are we doing? Project Healthy Schools. The first question is, well, do we really have that problem in our town? I mean, Ann Arbor's a wealthy community, right? We have a lot of smart people. We have access to healthy lifestyles. Shouldn't we be exempt from this problem? And of course we're not. This is a survey of 285 12-year-olds. 26% of the females are overweight or obese, and almost 40% of the males. And if you look at cut points that we think may correlate with later cardiovascular risk, whether it's blood pressure or cholesterol or the lousy lethal cholesterol or the healthy cholesterol or glucose, 61% of 12-year-olds in our town are at risk. I couldn't believe it. Well, I could believe it. My son would come home from middle school and say, Dad, today was great. We had tater tot day. He got twice the tater tots for a small amount of money. Or the 2-for-1 hot dog day. Or gosh, today was great because they brought in pizza and it was really hot. This program is in the middle schools. It's a program that says we're gonna try to use a school as a unit of intervention. And we're focusing, at least in this program currently, on middle school kids who make that transition from fifth to sixth grade. And we're going to try to get them right then when they're beginning to think about adult behaviors. And can we create an intervention that will help them think about their health in a new way? It's a huge effort. We're focusing on the students and their families, but the University Health System has been very involved, the Children's Hospital, the Cardiovascular Center, MFIT, the public, School of Public Health. A number of companies and community leaders are involved, and we're grateful for this large outpouring of interest in our kids. And if you look at what has happened, it's amazing. The health system and multiple entities, the Ann Arbor School District, the Ypsilanti School District. We have major donors, private and public, partner programs that I'll talk about briefly, number of community organizations that are involved, and we have health ambassadors. These are students who are studying to be doctors or nurses or nutritionists who volunteer in the program to help. We can't make a difference. So interestingly, we're not only in a community effort, but we're also in a training effort to try to create better citizens for the future. This is not reprocessed water. Peter, I promise I got this out of the back. So we have five simple goals. Eat more fruits and vegetables. Make better beverage choices. Perform at least 150 minutes per week of physical activity. Eat less fast and fatty food. And the last one, spend less mindless time in front of the computer. Every child is their own control. The idea is that let's not set unrealistic goals, let's focus. Five simple behaviors that if we did this reliably every day, would lead to a healthier child. Project Healthy Schools is about education, it's about changing the environment, it's also about measurement. So for families that are willing to let us study them, we're looking at the kids to see what happens. So that's where the research part of Project Healthy Schools comes in. All our kids get the program. It's in all the Ann Arbor middle schools and the Ypsilanti middle schools and several others I'll talk about. All of them get the program. But about half of them volunteer to also be a research subject so we can learn about what we're doing and see if we can make it better. We have health activities in the homerooms primarily where we teach interactive lessons with these 12-year-olds that emphasize those five simple goals. Okay? We have websites for the students to go to where they can learn and they can blog, e-news for the parents and e-communications. We work with the vendor for food to try to re-engineer the cafeteria offerings. We try to get the vending machines to change in healthy ways. And we really celebrate health. We have a field day in the spring. We have a kickoff in the school where we might bring in U of M athletes to celebrate health. And there's posters and other environmental reminders that a healthy child is a successful student. Study after study suggests that both nutrition and fitness correlate with success in the school activities of the child. So we try to celebrate that in the schools that we're in. For the kids that consent, we measure them. We do their height and weight, of course, their body mass index. We check their blood pressure. They do a stress test, and we check their resting and exercise heart rates. We check their lipids and their blood sugar, and they fill out a standardized questionnaire before and after our program where we try to sense, are they making change? Are they showing signs based on a standardized questionnaire that they're getting it and actually trying to change their lives? Let me ask a couple of good questions about Project Healthy Schools. First of all, does it reduce cardiovascular risk factors? Another question you might ask is, if it does, do its effects vary by gender or by race, ethnicity? You might ask me if it is successful in areas of lower socioeconomic class. Or you might ask me, does the program work in places that have low-income families? And if you see a benefit, are they sustained? You know, if it only works for a year and then they fall back. Well, that's like the Catskill Fat Farm, where one of my patients went this year and lost 40 pounds in 2 weeks and came back and gained 50 pounds in 3 months. That kind of a yo-yo is not healthy. It's actually worse than sustained obesity on your cardiovascular system. So the first program was in Clegg Middle School in 2004. And we saw before and after highly significant drops in cholesterol and blood sugar. How does obesity hurt you? Well, the biggest way it hurts your cardiovascular system is through your cholesterol profile, hypertension, and glucose. And in fact, if you remove those risk factors, then obesity is far less problematic, okay? Obviously, obesity also is correlated with cancers, like colon cancer. But if you improve cardiovascular risk factors in obese patients, even if they stay big, their longevity is much enhanced. So this was an early signal from 88 12-year-olds that, you know, it might work. We were surprised that the effects were this large in just 10 weeks. So here's data from 5 middle schools, 2006 through 2007. These are the Ann Arbor middle schools. And the gray areas represent areas of highly significant falls. The blood pressure changes are modest, a point or two. The cholesterol was 10 points. If this was a drug, your cardiologist would give you twice as much. LDL cholesterol dropped a little bit and triglycerides dropped a lot. So we had data from one school and then 5 schools, and you might ask, well, does it work in boys and girls, and what about race? The African-American kids had the biggest drops in cholesterol. The Caucasian kids had the biggest drops in triglyceride. And is it effective in boys and girls? Yeah, the diastolic pressure dropped a little bit. The cholesterol in boys dropped 11 points. The triglyceride dropped 20 points in these 400 plus boys, and in girls, the same. Diastolic blood pressure, cholesterol, lousy lethal cholesterol dropped, triglyceride dropped, random glucose a little bit. If you see these modest changes in multiple risk factors over a lifetime, what would happen? Cardiovascular risk would drop a lot. Studies that show a 3-point drop in systolic blood pressure over 5 years, that's associated with a major reduction in your risk of stroke. We're talking about 12-year-olds who have hopefully 60 to 70 years of life ahead. So if we could do this and it was sustained, this would be real risk reduction. If you look at different communities, we're interested in working in Ypsilanti. The sense was that perhaps Ann Arbor and Ypsilanti would be different. And if you look at the kids in Ypsilanti, there's 135 12-year-olds, about 600 kids in Ann Arbor. There certainly are differences in ethnicity, larger African-American in Ypsilanti, larger Asian population in Ann Arbor. And as you would expect, perhaps Ypsilanti has more body mass index, and they have 22% of these kids are obese versus 12% in Ann Arbor. How many grocery stores are there in Ypsilanti? Anybody know? Full-service grocery stores? I think one. I think there's one. They have far fewer parks. They have far less access to recreational activities than kids in Ann Arbor. And it shows they have a much higher rate of obesity. If you look at their consumption of different things, kids in Ypsilanti are less likely to consume milk, twice as likely to have French fries or chips in the day before, less likely to have vegetables. And if you look at regular soda, more than twice as likely to consume regular soda. And if you look at exercise time, number of PE classes, far less in Ypsilanti schools, sports teams, far fewer. If you look at TV watching, they are more likely to watch TV for more than 2 hours in a given day. And they're more likely to spend computer time and play video games. Just the things you talked about, Peter. We exercise on video games, and we eat fast foods. That example of that poor Asian kid who's a junkie to the computer game ordering fast food is really illustrative of this problem. If you ask, well, what about baseline data, kids in Ann Arbor versus Ypsilanti, the weights I mentioned already, the LDL cholesterol in Ypsilanti is almost 10 points higher on average than a 12-year-old in a community 5 minutes away. Isn't that amazing? And they're less fit, their recovery heart rate, than Ann Arbor kids. This is an indication of poor fitness. People who are fit, when they recover from a stress test, their heart rate comes right down. Poor heart rate recovery, delayed heart rate recovery, is a risk factor for coronary death. The good news is Project Healthy Schools works in Ypsilanti. If you look at cholesterol, it dropped almost 20 points in 120 kids. And the LDL cholesterol dropped 15 points, and the triglyceride dropped 12 points. So ironically, perhaps higher risk, more benefit. That's really good news. You might ask, well, what about long term? If you watch these kids over time, what happens to their risk factors over time? This is just two-year data, and probably the most important, the cholesterol, 167, 160, 149. LDL cholesterol, 91, 90, 82. I just saw the three-year data. I think, Susan, that just was last week, right? And the numbers continue to fall after 3 years. We feel very optimistic that the kids are getting it. They seem to get it. And the physiologic measures are consistent with an effect. If you look at the highest risk kids that have those markers I mentioned, higher systolic pressures, diastolic blood pressures, cholesterol, low healthy cholesterol, triglyceride, glucose, the kids with the worst markers have the most benefit. Triglyceride 270 to 169 among 48 kids. Here's 57 kids with an average cholesterol of 220, it dropped to 198. Systolic pressure 130 to 117. This is the kind of a dose effect that you would expect to see from a program that actually works. The kids at greatest risk should show the greatest benefit. Here are some examples of what changed in the cafeterias working with Chartwell's. And at first, they were very resistant to working with us. They didn't want to see anything that would change the bottom line. And gradually, over a period of years, I think the people in our audience here who work with the Chartwell's would say they're engaged now. I was in an elevator 2 years ago, and one of the faculty members, once the door closed, just he and I said, you know, my son Jason is very unhappy with you. I said, oh, that's great. Project Healthy Schools, he said, yeah. You eliminated the 2-for-1 hot dog day. I said, how do you feel about it? He said, I'm delighted. So 2-for-1 hot dog days, the double cheeseburgers, the 3-meat pizza went away. Pop-Tarts for breakfast, not a good idea. Donuts, cookies, candies in the stores. We've tried to eliminate these. White flour to whole wheat, fried chips to baked, Coca-Cola to good water, slushies to juice, and getting rid of pepperoni on pizza. And we can offer salad and fruit bars and carrots and ranch dip and yogurt, celery and peanut butter and whole grain toast and waffles and pancakes. Simple substitutions. Very simple. And you know what? If they're available, the kids will eat them. Now with a free breakfast and a free lunch for people of lower income, we can get these kids 2 meals of the 3. And if you do that for 18 years, or at least 5 through 18, 13 years, they might be healthier adults. If you ask the kids, this is a survey of 762 12-year-olds, what changed as a result of what you experienced in Project Healthy Schools? 26% said they spend less screen time, 30% more healthy drinks, almost 40% said now I eat more fruits and veggies, 39% less fast food, and over 40% say I get it about exercise and I'm doing more now. that should be consistent because their physiologic measures suggest that they are doing these things. And the data is clear. So we got to build a healthier community. We're connected to the YMCA and parent programs and the hands-on museums connecting science and health. Skyline High School is offering Project Healthy Schools as part of their health magnet, where high school kids are going to learn about health working with us. We're one of 14 communities in the country connected with the NIH in something called a We Can program. We have after-school programs, especially in communities that have few of these. We're involved with the Farms to School initiative in the area. We have farmers getting grants to come into the grade schools to talk to kids about farming and have them actually try vegetables that they may never have seen or tried. We started something called Free the Children clubs in three schools. Anybody know what that is? Anybody ever hear of Free the Children? Free the Children is a program developed by a 12-year-old in Toronto who was interested in creating a club that would promote health and community activism. And building on that program, we've started three Free the Children clubs in Ann Arbor middle schools. These kids meet, they celebrate health, they work on health, they also create fundraisers where they try to raise money to help kids or communities in faraway places that are really hurting. And I'll give you a couple of examples of that in a minute. The health ambassadors are very important, getting medical students, nurses, nursing, public health students. The concept that professionals like me don't just live in a vacuum. We're part of a community. And part of our obligation to the community is to connect with it and offer services that we have that might be beneficial. The Free the Children programs are numbering three. Over the years of Project Healthy Schools, we started with one school, and this year we'll be in 13. All Ann Arbor, Ypsilanti, we're in three schools in Owosso and Corunna. We'll be in two Detroit schools this year for the first time using an AmeriCorps grant. We have some of our colleagues trying to start programs in Rochester, New York, Tampa, Florida, Grand Rapids, Michigan. We sense that it works, and it's possible, and I think it can make a difference. The Free the Children's clubs in Ann Arbor have been wonderful. They've built schools in faraway places. They're getting water to communities that didn't have any. One of the schools, Susan, they collected 440,000 pennies.
The teacher
from Tappan, I believe, is here. One penny for every life lost in Darfur, and donated that. So these are the kinds of things that you can tie to health, activism, community leadership, and health. It all goes together. The work that I've showed you tonight is not mine. I mean, it's ridiculous for me to be representing it, really, because it's all the students, all the teachers, first and foremost, and then a whole team of people that we have who implement the program, the school board, people from MFIT who are actually in the schools doing the bulk of the work, our research team that's studying people from pediatrics. Dr. Peskovitz, the new vice president for health, is very much behind this program. And, I'm a button-down kind of guy, but I'm quoting you, the Grateful Dead. Somebody has to do something. It's amazing that it has to be us. We can do something. It doesn't have to be legislation. It can be one person at a time, you, me, them, working on a problem that's in our community. Last slide is one of the Free the Children schools that was built by an Ann Arbor middle school. These kids didn't have a school before. And this is the kind of thing that's possible. Let me stop, and again, thank you for the attention, and for my team members who are here, I salute you. Thank you. So do we want to open this up for questions now?
Yes, so if people have questions, please come to the floor, one here and one on the left. And Peter and Dr. Eagle will take your questions.
I'm Greer with Alvin Marketing.
No, actually, we need you to come to the microphone so that we can hear you on video, which may not be what you want, but it helps us.
Sorry.
Thank you very much.
But the calories that you're expanding are very good.
Okay. I just have an observation. Growing up in the early 60s in blue-collar Detroit, we all ate processed food. We had bologna, salami, Genoa salami, processed cheese, Hostess Twinkies, those little white cupcakes. You remember, it looks like a snowball. However, none of us were obese, and I think it's a very simple explanation, is exercise, because when we came home from school, it was, okay, go outside and play. And I'm BC, before computers. We had a TV that had two stations, which wasn't too riveting. So we did Red Rover and Hide and Seek and Ice Skate and Toboggan. And I'm just speculating if exercise is pivotal to your success. And also, I think ultimately the child's decrease in obesity is going to be between the parents and the child. Thank you.
Thank you. I mean, I agree totally. Exercise is a really important part of this. In Project Healthy Schools, I think we're finding that sometimes the child is getting the parent more involved. We've seen anecdotes after anecdotes of a situation where a child or two say, you know, we gotta move in a direction of healthier. Can we do that? Can help a parent or two who is embattled in a survival mode. Do you know what I mean? But yes, I mean, we need to get the parents as involved as we can.
Because we can't fail to know.
Correct.
Yeah. Now, you got to get everybody moving. And your point about parents setting an example, I mean, they can set an example, but it doesn't necessarily need to be a good example. My father was a chain smoker. And my wife's mother was a chain smoker. They're both dead of cancer, and none of their kids would touch a cigarette, you know? So we learned something, a real valuable lesson from our parents, but it wasn't through a positive role model, it was through a negative role model. So if you've got an obese parent, you know, check them out and don't let yourself do that.
I'm wondering whether school curriculum needs to be changed to help the kids to be learn to be healthy, because if you don't know how to cook, you cannot prepare healthy food at home, and you will be afraid, and people don't have money to buy and eat healthy food at expensive restaurants. So like learning to cook nutritious food and learn to grow a little bit, so a little bit of gardening needs to be included in the school.
Yeah, I think that's really important, getting that back in the schools where kids are learning how to, but it needs to be back in the families too as well. But there is, there are interesting studies that show the correlation between a family that cooks or people that cook and how obese they are. And it's a, you know, there's a definite correlation. People that do prepare their own foods are nearly as heavy and have the same problems as people that but we're losing that. I mean, we're, instead of cooking ourselves, we're watching other people cook on TV. I mean, come on, what's wrong with that picture?
So one of the, I mean, what you're getting at is that, you know, if we had our way, we would have more physical activity built into the school day, like perhaps it was when you and I were in grade school and middle school. There would be an opportunity for health-related electives that would promote this. But this is very challenging, of course, for schools where the demand for language and for the arts and for time for varsity sports, et cetera, and the fear of litigation or liability surrounding physical sports, which increasingly challenges schools. So it sounds much simpler than it is. Yes,
my statement in being African-American is a lot of the communities in which we reside, you don't have the fresh fruits in the markets, or you have to go, you know, so many miles, and if you're without transportation, then what would you suggest in the answering that syndrome, because I was raised in the country, and a country young lady, and, you know, had all those. But at moving into the city, you don't have a lot of the access, the fresh markets, and, you know, the fresh fruits and the in our rural, or either in some parts of the Flint, you know, I would say, they don't have the fresh markets. You got to go so many miles, and then what do you do for the families that 4 and 5, you know, siblings, and you don't have the transportation. So that in itself, a lot of individuals want to eat more healthier foods, but again, then you come up with the process of not having ways to getting there, or if you get to some of the markets, then the fruit is not fresh as it should be. So then what are you,
right.
What are your comments on that?
So I'll start, and I'm sure Peter will add to this. It's very important when we look at Ann Arbor and Ypsilanti, I believe the differences in obesity and behaviors is all about access. It's all about access. I don't think race and ethnicity is part of that equation at all. If you live in a town with no parks and no grocery stores, and your school programs offer little or no PE and very few organized sports, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to say the likelihood is, on average, families and children will be less healthy if you measure them. And so we have to work to improve the resources in those communities. You know, urban farming and, you know, the opportunity to have fresh fruits and vegetables in urban environments, we have to do that. And we have to figure out a way of offering healthy opportunities in the schools and after-school programs, too. So I'm really glad you asked that question, because I don't think it has anything to do with race. I think it has everything to do with resources. And we're not sharing them in a way which is healthy.
Yeah, I might add about, I'm not an advocate of the government doing a lot, but the government could do something in there. They could not subsidize corn and soy that are, you know, ingredients in a lot of fast, cheap food, and they could subsidize fruit and vegetables, making them cheaper. And if they did that, then people that were strapped economically, it would make more sense for them to be spending money on fresh, healthy things. And I would rather have my tax dollars go towards those kind of programs than to be you know, supporting military endeavors all over the world, but that's another point. But the other point is the FDA and the Agriculture Department and all that, they're looking after agriculture, but agriculture has become big business, and so they're not looking after the health of the people so much as they are looking after the health of certain big corporations, and that has got to stop. We have to start looking locally for produce and try to buy things that are coming from local farmers and supporting them, even though they might cost a little bit more. And we have to vote with our pocketbooks and really get out there and spend a little bit more on produce that's local and that's more healthy, and at the same time urge everybody in government to get off the you know, the dole, not the dole, but the handouts that they're getting from their constituents, and legislate some of this stuff so that fresh fruits and vegetables and healthy things are less expensive. It's basic.
We had a question here.
Regarding Health Hungry Planet, I would like to tell you that the photographs are amazing, especially the one that you showed here of the seal. I don't know how you got the bullet, just as it was going in the water. That was amazing.
Yeah, I was just lucky because my finger was really cold.
And my son was particularly impressed, one that wasn't shown tonight, of the young boy in Greenland eating the fish. He asked me if it was alive. I told him yes.
Yeah,
was that right?
Yeah. No, it came right out of the thing. And what was interesting about that picture, too, is that the stuff coming out of his nose is about the same consistency as the stuff that protects these fish in cold water. So it was just one big slimy fish that he was biting into. But those fish were actually delicious, and you know, you cook the fish and that stuff comes off.
I just moved here a year ago from rural Ontario, and I have to say that Ann Arbor is encouraging health. I use my bike now all the time. I can go to Whole Foods in 10 minutes on my bike. I can go to the farmer's market in 15 minutes, and safely too, because there are bicycle paths. So we're exercising more, we're eating more healthy food because of the way the city is set up. So that part is really great. And when we first, my children are 8 and 6. Last year I used the lunch program, and because my son really, really wanted to do what his friends were doing, so we used Chartwell's, and I really got discouraged by what was being served. And so this year I decided not to use it. So we're making our lunches this year, but I've had a look at the menu and it looks improved. Is that right from last year? It looks much better.
I think we're trying to work with Chartwell's to improve it every year.
I would, if there's anyone here from Chartwell's, thank you for making the baby steps. Yeah.
Baby steps.
Thanks.
I like your point about bicycles too. I mean, there's cities like Copenhagen and other cities in Germany where the majority, not the majority, but a large part of the morning commute and the afternoon commute is people on bicycles. And it's amazing to see so many people, you know, actually using pedal power to get to places, and everybody's benefiting from that. It'd be great if that happened more here.
Yes. Another question?
Yeah. I remember when I was more energetic, back in the day, the schools had the gymnasium. They had cooking class, and I was listening to her say, how'd you learn to cook good food and stuff like that? They had sewing, they had music, they had, you know, they had things that they don't have now. And government was giving out that chopped meat. We called it chopped meat. It was Spam in a can. And chicken and beef in a can and cheese. We loved the cheese. What happened to them programs?
What happened to the stuff in cans? I don't know. I grew up on that stuff too. I'm not
it's amazing we've lived so long.
Yeah. My mother thought, an adventurous thing would be to get ground beef and put a can of Campbell's tomato soup on top of it. That was like really a special meal, you know?
Yeah, so we've allowed that to get away, haven't we?
Yeah, we got to get back on that.
We need physical activity.
Well, they say it's finances, but you got to give a little to get a little.
I don't know if we're going to be able to answer that one. My anecdote about that is that, for me, Friday night was Italian night, and my mother took a can of Chef Boyardee spaghetti and 2 cans of Vienna sausages and heated it, and then we would watch Rawhide on TV. And I'm not sure we miss those days.
Yeah. I think, let me just say one thing too. I think the attitude that is pervasive these days politically is to cut taxes, not to pay taxes, to pay as little taxes as possible. We want these things in our schools, and we want these things in our communities, and they're not free. I mean, we've got to pony up for this stuff, and we've got to face up to the fact that, people in upper income brackets, it's not a crime for them to be paying 40, 50% of their income, you know? I mean, what's going on here? It's been, you know, we're being demonized for thinking that rich people should pay more. I mean, come on. And everybody that's got half a brain on TV that's fairly liberal said, I'd be glad to pay more to pay a larger percentage of my income to solve some of these problems. And I think that most educated, intelligent thinking people would go along with that. It's just, I think that America now has, the chickens are voting for Colonel Sanders. You know, they've been convinced that these people are throwing them chicken feed and they're voting for him, but they're leading him to the slaughterhouse. Anyway, that's as much as I can say.
We have time for 2 more questions, and then if you could take a moment to fill out your surveys. Thank you very much.
Yes. Right hand, Mike.
Yeah, I've got a specific question. This is for Peter. High fructose corn syrup, in your studies and what you're doing with all of your work, do you have any thoughts or can you speak about that, what that is doing to contribute to all this?
Yeah, it's everywhere. It's everywhere. And we've become more and more conscious of that now that we've done this book where we're examining calories of what everybody's eating. And we did our own, you know, this is something that I think that everybody, every American should really do, because it'll help you, it'll help your kids, it'll help you just understand what's going on today, is do a food diary. And there's certain websites like fitday.com, they're free. You just need a little scale, or you need some way to measure your food. Do it for a week or two and measure your calories, and then look at the analysis that these programs give you. It's amazing. And then start reading some of the labels and contents of food in a store, and you'll be just grossed out, you know? I mean, the thing that the fresh fruits and vegetables don't have a label, so you don't have to really worry about those. It's everything else that's processed in these places that are made that have high fructose corn syrup in them now, and it's just a real shame that that's so pervasive.
Question.
Well, obviously Project Healthy Schools is a big success while the kids are in school, and I was curious if you were doing any efforts to make sure that once they graduate or making their own choices, if they're going to keep those healthy behaviors, like
right.
When they have to do it on their own and they don't have the structure of the school or...
Right. So it's a great question. I hope that the kids are being educated to want to have a healthier lifestyle, and that this is a very formative stage, you know, grades 6 through 9 and 10, huge changes and many behaviors becoming adult-like. Certainly the physiologic changes over time suggest that the program has been sustained. Our ultimate hope is that the kids who graduate from Project Healthy Schools, who go to the high schools or to colleges, will come back and teach the middle schoolers the very lessons that are part of Project Healthy Schools, and that will go down to the grade schools, that middle schools would be teaching the grade schoolers. The kids love to listen to kids. They look at me and say, you know, he's an old geezer. I could care less. But if there's a kid there, they're snapping to attention. So one of our goals working with Skyline is to see if we can create synergy between middle school and high school and grade schools, and that we begin to build a whole effort from, you know, preschool all the way through high school that's reemphasizing these healthy choices. That's a great question.
Thanks.
Do we have time for one last question? Okay.
Yeah. Mine is more of a comment. What I see, I work with a lot of different families, and what I see in the schools is, I was up there recently and I was seeing them giving out the lunch card, and I could see the kids shunning away because it's about keeping up with the Joneses, and if you are getting food with this lunch card, you don't want it because you're labeled as poor and low privileged, and a lot of the kids won't take the lunch cards to get the healthier food. They want to look like they have money and want to purchase the food. In the summer, I do a breakfast and lunch program, and the kids, it was practically empty because the kids that could come and get the healthy food didn't want to be labeled as poor.
I guess what I would ask you to do is think about what you can do. Wherever you work, wherever you spend time, what can you do in this community to help it be healthier? Because we all have to work on this. It's a national crisis. It's the biggest health problem in the United States, and we are metastasizing it to China and India and other places. Each of you has a chance to make a difference here, and I hope that something Peter said or that I said would stimulate you to think about that. If we all work on it, it can change.
Yeah, I'd only like to add to that, we have to change. Change is difficult, but you know, we're not headed down the right path. And if we don't do it, we're going to have the first generation in history that has a lower life expectancy, and you know, it's not fun to be unhealthy, and it's not fun to pay really high health insurance bills that don't need to be that high if people pay more attention to it. So it's personal initiative and stuff. But I just wanted to thank everybody for coming too, and I wanted to know if there were three people here that had a birthday today or this week. We have some. I have some books here. All right, that's good. Anybody else? Here we go. We have one left. We have one more birthday person.
Right here.
Birthday here. Here you go. Happy birthday.
Thank you.